Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Let's kick off things today as we do every Saturday. Let's look at some business and indeed some other stories in this morning's papers online. And delighted to be joined by Louisa Meehan of Woodview HRM and also by Stephen O'Leary, the founder of Alitico. You're both very welcome.
Good morning, Bobby.
The program. Thanks for coming in bright and early. Stephen, we'll kick off with you. Critical flood defences still at design stage after 8 years. This is a bizarre story that seems to be, you know, unfurling over the last number of the weeks because we've had such flooding. But, you know, the length of time these flood defences are taking seems inexcusable.
It is. This is the front page of the Irish Times. And I always think it's useful to preface talking about these stories about considering the people who are truly impacted by it.
Big time.
The number of small businesses around the country who have had to close because of flooding, the number of homeowners who've had to rebuild or move is incredible. And in fact, in this piece, they talk about the Voluntary Homeowners Relocation Scheme, which opened in 2017 and has provided 7 million euros to 25 repeatedly flooded homeowners. Imagine this happening more than once during that time period.
It's a horrific thing to happen to anybody.
And that's where the statistics really come in. And I would imagine it's where a huge amount of the annoyance comes in here too, because in 2018, 8 years ago, 55 large flood defence projects were prioritised for development. Now, I think the word prioritised is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, because if something is a priority, it suggests that something will be done with pace. In 2026, 31 of those projects, over 57%, remain at what's described as a preliminary design stage.
Mad.
How can something be a priority? How can the government talk about this as being a priority and let things go on for that long?
And only 10 of those 54 are actually under construction.
This is it. And there's a few kind of things that are put forward as problems here. And one is the age old, the one we hear about all the time. It's planning, right? And this is put forward. However, most of the priority schemes are not yet in the planning system. So in this case, you can't point the finger at planning solely. There are other things that are brought up around environmental legislation and other pieces. But really, if we're serious about fixing these problems and we really care about these small business owners and these homeowners who are repeatedly impacted by this, then this type of work has to be prioritised.
Yeah. Louisa?
Look, I mean, I would agree completely with Stephen. I think that this article to me really indicates pointing the finger. Everybody's pointing the finger at somebody that's not them. You know, people are saying it's because of judicial review, and then the OPW are saying, well, actually, there's nothing currently under judicial review at present. And then, as Stephen said, the environmental piece is coming up around biodiversity.
And mussels.
And it's just everybody is saying it's somebody else's fault, and nobody seems to be taking accountability. And it seems to be going from one department to the next, to the other, and back and forth. Everybody's saying it has to be fixed, but nobody is fixing the problem.
Now, it must be a slow news day, and it is Valentine's Day, and happy Valentine's Day to all those loving people out there, all those lovers. We'll talk a bit of love later on as well. But RTE doesn't seem to be getting much love today, Stephen.
Yeah, this is a piece in the Irish Independent, a really interesting piece from Fionnán Sheehan and Melanie Finn about Ryan Tuberty and RTE clashing over their request to see the pay scandal files. And at its centre of the story, this is a data request piece. So Tuberty has requested data in relation to this story from RTE. One of the absolute standout lines in this piece, and there's a huge amount of coverage given to this, is the cost to RTE from these data requests.
100 grand, is it?
Like, this is the quote. In response to the data access request, RTE has provided material requested by solicitors on behalf of Ryan Tuberty and Noel Kelly at a substantial cost in excess of 100,000 euros. The issue that remains outstanding is that they believe they are entitled to more material and RTE disagrees. Now, the question I would have is, how on earth has it cost 100,000 euros to provide the data to the two people who requested it? What, like, that is a really important and serious question, I think, to ask, because we are hearing and seeing how much AI is now able to do. We know how many things like data requests can be automated. I understand you need legal experts, data experts and others to get involved in things like this, but that is still a staggering amount of money.
I bet you most of it is legal costs.
Yeah. I would say it is, because I mean, actually producing the documentation isn't that complicated. He's not asking for documentation on everything he's ever done on RTE. It's really in relation to the scandal. Ultimately, RTE were responsible for publishing the salary details in relation to Ryan Tuberty. Whether he should or shouldn't have come out and said that they were right or wrong is on him, but RTE published the information. They published incorrect information about him, and he was the fall guy. He took responsibility.
Yeah.
He's clearly saying that his issue is with the board as opposed to with Kevin Backhurst, but himself and Kevin Backhurst seem to have had some form of a private meeting this week, which people are trying to figure out what happened in, and this GDPR issue did come up. The GDPR request, though, is, you know, I think it's 2-3 years old. It was made in November 2023. Like, I work in HR. GDPR requests should not be taking nearly 3 years, yeah. No matter what he's asking for. Either there is something that he really wants to get that he believes is there, that they really, really don't want to give him, or something's gone terribly wrong here. A GDPR request is typically somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks. So how something that isn't this complicated is taking this long is crazy.
The big question here for me is that is the data request a precursor to legal action?
Well, Ryan is saying it isn't, that he's just very curious and he'd love to see it. He could be planning a book.
Let's see. But as I say, it's a story that seems to keep on giving, Stephen.
Yeah, it's also a sign of like how small Ireland is.
Yeah.
Because he was interviewed by an RTE station within the last couple of weeks and he was featured in an RTE news publication. So, I mean, you know, the fact that he's there giving these interviews at this time does show you that, yeah, we have kind of short memories.
Yeah.
Out of office, Stephen, while I have you there, revolt against Microsoft spreads across the EU. This is a story coming from Germany about our over-reliance on big American tech, search engines, etc., and software support, that maybe we should be cutting loose.
I would argue that this is the most consequential news story, certainly of this week, potentially of the year to date. I think we're possibly underestimating, you know, just how much of a tipping point this might be. And I will be fascinated in a year's time to actually see when we maybe pick this up again, where we've gotten to. So this is a piece coming out of the European meeting this week, and it centers around that idea of sovereignty, ultimately, right? And the fact, can Europe take control of things? And what for me this comes back to is a story about trust. And there are three key pieces of trust within this. The first is, does Europe trust Trump? And by extension, the US. And that is very much in question. We're seeing that in the conference that's taking place this morning. The second is, does Europe trust big tech, as we call them, to be independent of that US administration? So do we trust that the US administration won't step in and tell a big tech firm, we want you to throttle access to technology to Europe? And then the third one is, do we trust the alternative? Because very often we default to the standard, right? And there are several companies mentioned here that we would describe as being the standard bearers, right? They're the email appliances, the search engines, all the things that we take for granted as just being the standard applications. But the story also details, particularly out of Germany, local areas. So one is compared, I think, to a province almost the size of Leinster, who have done away with the traditional suppliers in these spaces and actually built their own solution.
So is there a credible alternative?
Well, this story would suggest there is. And again, where this comes in on trust is can someone show me that if I make this decision, I'm not going to end up with something that doesn't work,
yeah,
like my old system? And what we're seeing out of Germany and France are local governments and local areas saying, well, look, here is a viable alternative. And I think there will be a lot of conversation at this event in Europe over the next couple of days where different European leaders talk to each other and say, well, what are you doing in this space? Can we make this move and change? I feel this is a really pivotal moment, yeah, in the industry.
Louisa, Derek Scally has a follow-up piece to it talking about Mertz warning that America's global leadership is no longer unchallenged, and basically standing up to the US and saying, you know, you can go it alone if you want, but it isn't a great idea.
Yeah, and I think that's the key message here, is that the European leaders are not saying we don't want to be an ally of the US. What they're saying is, if you want to be our ally, we would love to be your ally, but you need to treat us with respect. And if you don't treat us with respect, then we don't need to work with you and we can do it alone. It does talk a little bit about, even within the US government itself, that the Democrats who are present are really trying to emphasize that Trump is not the only version of America that exists. And America does want to be allied with Europe and with other strong partners. And please sort of, it's coming across to me a little bit like, please bear with us. We'll get through this storm and we will work again with you once we have fixed the problems that we have at home, or the difference of opinions. That's what's sort of striking to me in it.
Okay. Electric cars, Stephen. New electric cars licensed up 61%. But a bit of a diesel pushback.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And again, this is a piece by Ronan Smith in The Examiner. And I would like to begin by praising the CSO for data. Again, I think sometimes we take for granted just how valuable an organization they are. And the reason we have this story today is thanks to their data and research. So you're absolutely right. This talks about changes year on year in the number of licensed new electric cars, up 61% in January versus the same time in 2025, which is an incredible leap. But it feels like this story is kind of a tale of two halves, right? On the one hand, very positive news in terms of the uptake of electric vehicles. Certainly, I think also really interesting to see the combined share of petrol and diesel cars among new private cars fell from 43% a year ago to down to 31% in Jan 2026. However, it feels like this is the culmination of a decade of pressure and focus on climate and sustainability. Mm-hmm. And what the second half of the piece warns us is that that is potentially starting to shift. So it points to the fact that, I suppose, through Trump in the US, but also at a European level, where there has been a shift in terms of the watering down, is how it's described, of emission targets, and that will allow combustion engines to stay around for longer. And indeed, we're starting to see private companies who manufacture in this space respond to this and ramp up their production in combustible
engines. There's a cost issue here as well, because I was kind of surprised to see that petrol was down 22% and diesel was down 20%. I would have thought that diesel should have been down far more than petrol, given the trends that we've seen.
Yeah.
And it's like, there is definitely an issue around the cost of electric versus the cost of a diesel.
And that point is made. We know about the cost of living crisis, as it still is. And the point is made in this, that diesels carry a much lower price tag than the fully electric models. And the fact that that is giving them an advantage when it comes to car makers who are struggling.
Yeah. Louisa?
Yeah, look, I mean, I drive a diesel car. And whilst I, for environmental reasons, I understand the benefit of electric, given the mileage that I do, it's just not viable because it takes too long to charge the car. So I'm not moving into electric anytime soon. And I think there's probably a split here between people who are driving within a certain small geographical area and then they can have electric cars versus people who are doing longer distance journeys and it just isn't viable yet.
So people know that I have an electric car and I also then use my daughter's car when I'm wanting to go on a long journey. So I kind of have the best of both worlds.
That's what you need.
So I'm putting my hand, honestly, on that one. Very good news story here. This is an amazing company. It's a company I know well. A company called Zeus, owned by Brian O'Sullivan. They've bought a Spanish company, Stephen, for $24 million. I used to deal with Zeus going back in the day. They're a wonderful company. And they're acquiring, I think Brian said himself, the owner and founder, they're acquiring mom and pop type companies. But they're going to turn over $600 million next year.
Yeah, there's not a lot of mom and pop about this, Bobby. I think what I love about this, I suppose, is that it's another Cork good news story, which is what we need. And also, I think a really interesting reflection on the EY Entrepreneur of the Year program, right? So this is another alumni with a good news story. Obviously, the winner in 2021. But it's an incredible acquisition spree that they're going on, right? So €90 million spent over the last 3 years. And this acquisition in particular feels like it benefits from both that economy of scale piece, right? So they're buying into something here that will give them that real end-to-end solution across their client base, but also some real blue chip companies that they're acquiring as clients. I mean, these are some of the biggest brands in the world. You see Burger King, Hugo Boss, McDonald's, Tag Heuer. There's some really, really household names listed in there. But I think you made the point, and I think this is probably central to this. It feels like the cultural cultural fit is right here. And it really feels that O'Sullivan has focused on that, that this is not just about acquiring a company that fits well from an economic point of view. This is about finding the right people, the right structures, companies that are run in the right way. And it's a really exciting time for the business.
Louisa, we'll move to the recession today. Is in marriage and fertility, says an economist, as he and his fiance prepare for their wedding day. This is a story that just caught our eye this morning about Lauren Stewart and David Higgins. They've got married, but he's making the point that almost a third of Irish men are now over 40 when they tie the knot.
Yeah, look, it's the story itself is really focused around the couple and what they've been doing, the pre-marriage course and all of that good stuff that they did. But some of the information he's bringing up, as you said, in relation to people getting married over the age of 40 is quite interesting. He himself is 33 and his now wife is 34. But during the week, I think this is tying into a story that came up during the week where in Italy, they're encouraging people to have children by the age of 29. And even Rona Mahoney, the past master of Holles Street, was on News Talk during the week talking about this in terms of fertility. Because, you know, we can talk all we want about people getting married later in life, having children later in life, all of the things that you want to do in your 20s and 30s. But the reality, the biological reality for both men and women is that the earlier you have children, the safer it is. And when we are looking to the future and we all need people to pay for our pensions and, you know, maintain us in our nursing homes, we need there to be people coming out and being born now in order to have people working in 40 years' time.
The impact of all this is significant. Societally.
It's a societal impact.
Yeah.
What one thing that is interesting in here is not so much about marriage and fertility, but it's the shift for the younger population. So the 18 to 24 year olds heading back towards religion. And religion seems to be becoming more and more important.
Well, I wonder about that. Is it the shift towards religion or is it that they just want to get married in a church? I think they're two different things.
I think there's a lot of evidence coming out to say that there is a move back towards religion amongst the younger population. It's not the first time I've come across this information. And people identifying as being Catholic or whatever their religion might be, there seems to be a need amongst that population to belong and to find something to belong to. So we'll see.
I'm all for the church wedding.
Yes.
Well, the piece that underpins this is some research that Accord did with Amoric Research amongst that kind of younger generation. And on that point, Bobby, they say that 47% of Catholics are aware that it's possible to have a wedding ceremony in a church without also having a mass. And fewer than a quarter of Catholics are aware of what's called convalidation ceremonies, where a church wedding can take place after a civil ceremony. So it is very possible that kind of coverage like this will encourage more people to look and explore the idea of a church wedding.
Well, my parents are married for longer than I'm alive, so I'm not going to give the number of years away. But they got married on Easter Saturday because they wanted to. And because it was before Easter Sunday, they were not allowed to have a mass.
Wow.
So a very long time ago.
Wow. These times, they are a-changing. Stephen, the story you alerted us to this week, social media companies, this is staggering stuff. Social media companies made $32 million serving scam ads to Irish users, research estimates.
Yeah,
this is a bizarre story.
It is, and it's a very complicated one, Bobby. Not so much in its subject matter, but in some of the questions I think it raises for the social network.
And one of the reasons we like you as a guest, a Business Review guest, is you're very good at explaining complicated stories in simple ways, Stephen. So I'm going to ask you to do that now.
Well, this, again, much like our previous story, is based on research that was commissioned. In this case, the research firm are Juniper and Revolut are the company that commissioned it. And it was done at a European level. So they wanted to look and see, essentially, how many people and how much money was being generated by what are described as scam ads on social networks. Now, all of your listeners will be familiar with this, right? Those ads that pop up in our feeds that purport to be selling a product or service, sometimes featuring the image of someone who is very famous or well known, and it turns out that the ad is a scam.
And one in 10 ads is fraudulent, according to that research.
Yeah, and it's not just the number of ads, but it's the number of times they're being seen by people each month. So on average, 164 scam ads per month are being seen in Ireland. And social media companies, this is where this gets complicated. They made €32 million last year based on ads served to Irish.
So if there's no fraudulent ads, they're down 32 million.
And that's why this is complicated. Yeah. Because there is a strong argument to say, well, it's actually in the interests of these companies to allow the ads to continue running because they're making revenue from them. And yet, like, and I think this is a really interesting piece in this, this isn't the only source of information we have here. So recent data presented to the Oireachtas Finance Committee by the Central Bank of Ireland suggested that 80% of payment fraud in Ireland originates on social media. Now, I am obviously an exponent of social media. I see all the good it can do. I think it can be a really powerful and positive thing. But the onus is on the social media platforms to clean this up. Because if they don't, trust will be diminished.
Okay. Louisa, a story that caught your eye. Lawyers arguing that an Apple worker who was fired over a tramps and whores remark, he went too far. Tell us more.
So this is based on an Apple distribution down in Cork, and Mr. Dos Santos had a complaint under the Unfair Dismissals Act for unfair dismissal. So last May, there was a grievance raised in relation to him, and there were 18 separate issues. They were very concerning remarks around very gender-based slurs. So the situation here is that he talked to women about women being tramps and whores, about being thing this, thing that. It is still with the WRC for review. He's saying that there was a culture where this language was acceptable within the...
Sure, Apple aren't very happy about
Apple
that.
Apple are not happy about it. So we have to wait and see what the actual outcome will be. It has gone back for adjudication.
Well, look, we'll keep an eye on that. I wanted to do love songs, but we're after running out of time. So I'm going to be a real killjoy on Valentine's Day and not play a love song. So I'm going to thank Stephen O'Leary and Louisa Meehan for their Valentine's contribution here this morning, and apologise to them both that I can't play their favourite love songs.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.